It's time to turn to the WUKY Sports page with your host, Keith Elkins, revealing conversations and stories you thought you knew from prominent Kentucky sports figures. Now, here once again is Keith Elkins.
Chris McCarron is with us today. He is a Hall of Fame jockey and a two-time Kentucky Derby winner. He won 6 Triple Crown events in all. He won 9 Breeders' Cup races, including 5 Classics and many, many other major races. He led North American jockeys in earnings 4 times and led in wins 3 times. He won an Eclipse Award for Outstanding Apprentice Jockey in 1974 and another Eclipse for Outstanding Jockey in 1980. He was inducted into the National Museum of Racing Hall of Fame in 1989. He retired in 2002 with 7,141 wins, currently 7th all-time, and purse earnings of nearly $264 million, a record at that time. He served as technical advisor, racing designer, and had an acting role as Hall of Fame jockey Charlie Kurtzinger in the 2003 film Seabiscuit. And he also founded the North American Racing Academy to help develop the skills of young riders. Chris, it's great to have you with us. Thanks for being on today.
Thank you, Keith. I appreciate you having me on.
Well, we're, of course, just a couple of days away from Kentucky Derby as we record here today on Thursday. What is Derby Week like for you at this stage of life?
Well, it's just a whole lot of conversation amongst friends and doing some interviews, such as this. And and then tomorrow I've got a couple of jobs over at the track entertaining people. And this year, for the first time in many, many years, I'm actually not going to the Derby. I'm going to a friend's house who he suffered a stroke about 5 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And so he's confined at home. So I'm going to go and hang out with Johnny all day.
Well, that'll be, I'm sure, much appreciated and a very different setting for you, but I'm sure much appreciated by him. So I hope you enjoy the Derby. Before we get more into your career, of course, this week we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of Secretariat's great run to the Triple Crown. This was just before your breakout year in racing. What do you remember about that 1973 Triple Crown season?
Oh, man, it was, I remember it like it was yesterday. In 1973, I was an exercise rider in Maryland, and I happened to be at Pimlico working on the backstretch for my boss. And I was up on a balcony of one of the barns when Secretariat came by us at the 5-furlong pole, and he was just absolutely running off with Ron Turcotte. That horse had so much eagerness. He so wanted to run, and it was, quite the spectacle. And then, of course, capped off by one of the most exhilarating races of any kind anyone would ever see, and with Secretariat winning by 31 lengths. But his Derby was as impressive as any race he ever ran, because he ran each consecutive quarter during the running of the race faster than his previous quarter, which going a mile and a quarter is unheard of. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely unheard of. So he still holds the track record of 159.2. So that track record, stakes record, has been in place for 50 years.
Yeah, it's just been an amazing story and one that attracted the attention of the country at large. I mean, not just the racing industry or racing fans, but people seem to really attach to Secretariat as a sports hero, and that has carried through to this day. And those of us who are fortunate enough to remember watching that, it was quite a thrill at the time, even for people like you who are professionals.
Yeah, that's right. That was just an amazing accomplishment. And I love how the people who were and still are connected to Secretariat, they've done a great job, maintaining and carrying on his legacy. Mm-hmm. You know, they've got a nice, beautiful display of Secretariat's accomplishments up in Paris, where he stood stud at Claiborne Farm for many years, and it's very impressive. And I encourage anybody who's interested or even not interested in horse racing, go check it out.
Well, tell me about your initial interest in horse racing. I know your brother had a lot to do with that.
That's correct, Keith. I was a freshman in high school in Boston in 1969 when my brother Greg started riding. He's 6.5 years my elder, and he taught me how to watch a race. More importantly, he taught me how to calculate how much money jockeys were making. Yeah. And during my formative years, I was still in high school. I went to school in the north end of Boston, and Suffolk Downs, unfortunately, which is no longer, but Suffolk Downs at the time had its own train station. I would get on the train and go only 3 stops, and it would take me all of 10 minutes to get there. And I would get off the train, go over to the track, which is walking distance, and I would climb the fence, because if you were under 18 and not accompanied by an adult, they wouldn't let you in. So I would sneak in. I'd climb over the fence and just hang out on the clubhouse turn and watch my brother ride the last few races on the card. And I was so excited about watching that. And then between my junior and senior year in high school, Greg got me a job walking horses at Rockingham Park with the gentleman who taught him how to ride. And I did that for 2 months, and I was infatuated with the whole thing. And my infatuation turned into love for the animal. And so I could not wait until I graduated high school in 72. And the day after my graduation, I was on the track, and I've been there ever since.
Now, in following your brother's rides, of course, and learning about the sport almost from the inside, in getting that firsthand look at it, were you also a fan? Did you have jockeys that you followed, whose careers you followed at that time, or was that something that maybe came a little later as you got into it yourself?
Well, I was Greg's fan, number one. I learned to form an affinity for several other jockeys. When I got on the track for good back in 72 rather, my boss had moved his outfit to Maryland from his original circuit was New England in the spring, summer, and fall. And he would go down to New Orleans in the wintertime, but he was up in age. He was like in the 70s, and he didn't want to do all that moving around. So he picked Maryland because at the time they had year-round racing. And I'm so glad that he did that, because the class of horses and horsemen and people involved with the thoroughbred industry was much higher in Maryland than it was in New England. So I had the opportunity to watch much more talented, much more successful jockeys while I was working for my boss. And so I developed a great respect for riders like now these people are not nationally known, but they were very popular in Maryland. Bill Passmore, Leroy Moyers, Eric Walsh, a whole host of jockeys who were very, very talented. And I would just pay so close attention to watching the races, and Greg would continually teach me what to look for and who was doing things right and who was making mistakes out there. And so I had a crash course in how to watch a thoroughbred racehorse. And it was a lot of fun.
Well, you certainly took to it right away with the huge year in 1974, 546 winners that year. That was the year you turned 19 years old, won an Eclipse Award that year as the Outstanding Apprentice Jockey. What was the key to getting the career off to such a fast start? Because you think about trying to work your way up, but you were moving toward the top pretty quickly.
Yeah, it was, for lack of a better way of saying it, it was a meteoric rise. Number one, God blessed me with a talent to communicate with horses. Communication, having a communication skill is number one. And when a person is fortunate enough to possess that ability, he or she can get along with horses much more readily. I learned how to read a horse. I learned how to understand what the signals were. Horses are always communicating with us. It takes a trained eye and a trained person, like emotionally, excuse me, to learn what the horses are telling us. And so with that ability, I was able to transform into a great communicator with them. And it, you know, the number one thing we're trying to achieve with a thoroughbred racehorse is cooperation. Now, that cooperation comes in many forms. It could be just being in a stall, asking the horse to move over a little bit so you can muck the stall. Ask the horse to stand still while you're putting the tack on him. Ask the horse to walk professionally and carefully around the shed row. Ask the horse to accept me when I get up on his back. And then the rest of it, you know, continues. The communication and cooperation continues as you're walking down to the track, as you go around the race course, you know, and coming back. A lot of the times those thoroughbreds are feeling so good, they want to play all the time. And so you got to keep your wits about you. The communication is the channel through which we get cooperation.
And that's very interesting because I'm sure as fans we watch and we see and we know that there must be communication between jockey and horse during the race or leading up to a race. But as you're saying, these are little things that build that relationship so that you'll have that good communication during the race, right? I mean, it all contributes to the finished product.
And that's exactly right. So when I'm working with a horse, the first and foremost thing I do is try to develop that confident relationship with them. I want the horse to accept me as a passenger, as a partner. I want the horse to understand that I'm there as a partner, and I want the horse to feel more comfortable under me than he would under other riders. And consequently, using that attitude, using that method, I was able to communicate and get horses to perform for me much more so than, say, other riders.
Mm-hmm. That led to an Eclipse Award in 1980 as the Outstanding Jockey. Tell me about that year and what made it such a great year for you.
Okay, so I rode the first 4 years of my career in Maryland at Bowie, which is no longer Laurel and Pimlico Racecourse. I also rode at Delaware Park, Monmouth Park, Atlantic City, all those tracks in the Mid-Atlantic. And then in 1978, after four very successful years, it was time for me to take on new challenges. And I had two choices. I could either go to New York, which at the time was the number one racing circuit in the country, if not the world, or go to Southern California. Well, in 1976, I was invited by the owner of Hollywood Park to fly out there and compete in an all-star race. So I went out to Hollywood Park, and I fell in love with it. You know, the weather is fantastic. The track is beautiful. Unfortunately, that track's no longer with us either. It's now SoFi Stadium out in Los Angeles, yeah, where the Rams and the Chargers played. So I made it my goal that when the time was right, and I had learned about as much as I possibly could from the jockey colony in Maryland, I would move out to Los Angeles. And I did that on March 27th, 1978. My wife and I had driven across country, and she was pregnant at the time with our first child. And so I started plying my trade out there in Arcadia, California, at Santa Anita Park, and then moved our tack to Hollywood Park when it opened shortly after Santa Anita closed. So and then fast forward to 1980, which is to address your question. We were halfway through the year, and I was leading rider in the country in both races won and money won. And my agent suggested to me that if we're going to try to win the money title, which is more important than the races won title, then we're going to have to move our tack to New York, because Angel Cordero, who was hot on my tail, he was going to do whatever he could to win the money title. What that entailed was riding day and night. Angel was going to be riding in the afternoon at Belmont Park, and then when that closed, at Aqueduct. And then after the races, drive 16 miles to the Meadowlands. Wow. Now, it's only 16 miles, but it would take about an hour to get over there. It's in East Rutherford, New Jersey. So my agent said, if we have any chance at all to hold them off, we're going to have to do the same thing. So I moved my tack to Belmont Park the day after Del Mar closed, and right after Labor Day in September. And so I went to I went back there, and sure enough, I was riding day and night. I was averaging, 15, 16 races a day.
Wow.
And so we were able to accomplish our goal. I was leading rider at Aqueduct and the Meadowlands. And so we were able to win the races won and Money Won title. So it took a tremendous amount of work. I was away from my family. At the time, I had two young daughters. They were, Aaron would have been two and Stephanie was one. And I was staying in a hotel right by JFK. And so they were long days. I'd get up in the morning, go out to the track, ride in the afternoon at Aqueduct, and then drive across to New Jersey and ride at the Meadowlands at night. And then I would get back to my hotel every evening around 12:30, 1 o'clock in the morning, because the last race at Meadowlands ran at 11 o'clock at night. So it was a whirlwind effort. And fortunately for us, it paid off.
It did. And I'm just thinking of the challenge of retaining. You have to have such tremendous focus on every race. Was could you feel the effects of the fatigue by the end of a long day like that?
It really depends on the types of horses that you're riding. Now, if it so happens that I've ridden a bunch of horses both the afternoon and evening that really, took some hard riding. So a lot of horses, most horses are very cooperative. But then every once in a while you get some lazy ones and you have to really work to get them to run the best. And, it all depends on how the day went as far as that goes. But generally speaking, yes, I would be pretty tired at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've made your what turned out to be life-changing connection with Ali Sheba in the spring of 87, but you were coming off an injury. Of course, injuries are going to be part of it. Everybody, I guess, has to know that going in, but you were pretty seriously injured in the fall of 86 and just making a comeback. Is that right?
Wow, Keith, you're doing great. You've really done your homework.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, on October 16th of 1986, I was involved in a spill at Santa Anita Park. It was a 5-horse spill, and I was the 4th rider and horse to go down, and the 5th jockey was Lafitte Pincai Jr., who I think is the GOAT, greatest of all time. He ended up landing on my left leg as I was tumbling across the ground. And my right leg acted as a fulcrum, and the left leg, the left femur, broke in 4 places.
Oh, gosh.
So I had a plate with 11 screws surgically implanted, and I was out of action for about 6 months, not quite 6 months. And I started riding back in, the end of March, I guess it was, and I was walking through the stable area at Santa Anita Park, and Jack Vanberg, who trained that beautiful animal, Ali Sheba, stopped me. He was leading a horse and coming back off the racetrack, and he said, "Hey, Jock, when you start back riding?" I said, I'm going to ride this weekend, Jack." He goes, "Oh, okay, good." He said, "How fit are you?" I said, I'm pretty fit, but I need to get a little bit fitter, and I can only do that by riding races." He said, "All right, good." He said, "I want you to come by the barn on Saturday morning." So I went to his barn, and he led Ali Sheba out of the stall. And I recognized him because I knew he was a pretty good colt. And I said, "Wow, man, I'm going to get to breeze Ali Sheba." And so that's how I got the mount. Pat Day had been riding him, but Pat opted to ride another horse in the Kentucky Derby because Pat won 3 consecutive stakes races at Oaklawn Park in Hot Springs, Arkansas. That horse's name was Demons Be Gone. And Demons Be Gone actually went off as the Derby favorite that year, but unfortunately did not finish the race because he bled out his nostrils, and Pat Day had to ease him up. So then I crossed the finish line in front on Ali Sheba, but not cleanly. Turning into the stretch, the horse, I had one horse left in front of me, and that horse bet twice, ducked out in front of us, and Ali Sheba actually clipped his heels and tripped. Mm-hmm. And he came very close to actually falling, but he was such a great athlete, and he was so fit that he was able to right himself and get up and go on and run by and bet twice. And when I stood up at the finish line, I was elated. Oh, my God, I just won the Kentucky Derby.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and the thrill of a lifetime, no matter how many races you've won, I'm sure. But, you know, if those listening, if you haven't seen the video or if you haven't seen it for a while of that 87 Derby, go back and look at it, because when you say it was a near fall for Ali Sheba, the horse's head went down, and it really looked like that he was going down, which means you and maybe several others might have gone down as well. It was just short of disastrous, it seemed.
Yes, that's right, Keith. if he had fallen at that point, there were 17 horses behind us, mm-hmm. and there's no telling what kind of a wreck would have ensued. But like I say, God blessed us with some athletic ability, and he was able to recover and showed a tremendous amount of determination.
Is that a situation? It all happens so fast. It happens there in a split second. Is there anything you do in that situation, or is that just something that the horse has to react and, as you say, be an athlete and regain his balance on his own, or do you have anything at all to do with that at that point?
I had a little something to do with it. I'd say probably 10% of the effort to right himself. Mm-hmm. What my job at that point is, you know, I've had people tell me over the years, oh, my goodness, that was so close. You reached down and you picked him back up. Well, guess what? Ali Sheba weighed, Jack used to say his fighting weight was 1,075 pounds. So that horse weighs 1,000, he weighs a ton, half a ton. And there's no way I can pick him up. But what I could do and what I did was to get back in the saddle, get back, sit down for a second, a split second, and get out of his way. You know, I had to get, if my weight went forward up over his neck, well, I'm adding, you know, 115 pounds up on the front of him, which made it more difficult for him to right himself. So all I did was I got back in the saddle, way back, and tried to alleviate. Excuse me. Try to alleviate some of that weight up front, you know.
You mentioned after the race that you felt like you still had a lot of horse under you as you got ready to make a stretch run. That's an expression that we hear jockeys use from time to time. But break that down a little bit for us. I mean, part of that, I would think, would go back to that communication that you had, that you know when the horse has a lot left. But what goes into that to give you that feeling, okay, we're not only ready to run, he's got something left to run with?
Well, the number one indication is how he was blowing by horses around the far turn. He not only had trouble in the stretch, but he had trouble in the stretch the first time by the stands. You know, we broke out of the four hole, and the horses from the outside of us just came over fairly quickly in the first, you know, eighth of a mile, first furlong. And they crowded us really badly, and I had to take up again. My butt hit the saddle for a split second, and now I find myself way back. I think there was only one horse behind me going by the stands the first time. And as we went around the first turn, I saved ground, but when I straightened down the backstretch, I moved Ali Sheba out to the outside where he would have clear sailing. And when he got to the outside, he's no longer catching all that sand up in his face. Which a lot of horses dislike. He got to the outside, and then he just picked it up right away. He started easily going by horses, and the further we went down the backstretch, the more momentum he was building. And from the 3.5 furlong pole to the quarter pole, we passed the majority of the field. And at that point, all I can hope for is that he's going to have enough energy, enough stamina left to keep that run going. And sure enough, he did.
Well, it was a great victory for you, and as you've indicated, a life-changing victory. But after that win, how did life change for you? I mean, you were at the top of your game, of course, in terms of wins and awards and things like that, but getting that first Derby win, what did that mean to you?
It meant the world. You know, that's on everybody's bucket list, whether you're a jockey, a trainer, an owner, a breeder, an exercise rider, a groom, whatever. It's the biggest prize in racing. And so, I mean, globally, it's the biggest prize in racing. And so, you know, it meant the world. I did a lot of traveling throughout my career, and I would always take my tack bag with me on the plane. I never wanted to check it because I didn't want to get to my destination only to find it didn't arrive. Uh-huh. So I would carry it on, and I would have a riding crop that was attached to my bag. It was on the outside of the bag. And people would say, you know, somebody might be sitting beside me. Oh, hey, wow, what is that? Some people would recognize it's a riding crop. Other people would say, what is that? And I would explain, and a conversation would ensue. And then the first question would be, other than what is that, the next question I should say would be, wow, have you ever ridden in the Kentucky Derby? Mm-hmm. And up until 1987, all I could say was, yes, I have. I've ridden a few times. And did you win it? Well, no, I finished second twice. I was second in 83 on behind Sonny's Halo and 86 behind Ferdinand. But after 87, when they asked me if I had won it, then I would just kind of like unconsciously stick my chest out. Yes, I have won it, you know. So it was life-changing in that way. And, it, you know, back in 83 and 84, I was a regular pilot for John Henry. And he was nationally, if not globally, known as a terrific turf horse. And he kind of put my name, he solidified my name nationally he because he traveled. He won in New York, he won at the Meadowlands, New Jersey, and he won a ton in Southern California and Chicago. And so that helped my career, because when you get that kind of exposure, you have trainers from all over the place calling my agent, asking me if I would come ride a horse for them somewhere. And then when Ali Sheba got that job done, you know, that catapulted me even further on the national stage and the global stage.
Well, you came back with another Derby win in 1994 with Gopher Gin and nearly a wire-to-wire win, and that was, to say the least, a sloppy track at Churchill Downs. And so tell me about the strategy that day, how it changed because of the weather, and then how that race played out.
Yeah, the favorite that year was a very, very good horse called Holy Bull. Mm-hmm. Holy Bull was the heavy 8-5 favorite, and Gopher Gin had a really good record. He was second or third in some really big prep races, most notably the Fountain of Youth and the Florida Derby at Gulfstream Park, and then the Wood Memorial in New York. And so Jerry Bailey had been riding him at that point. And Jerry Bailey finished second on him in the Wood Memorial. And the horse that beat him was a horse called Ergun, trained by a close friend of Jerry's. And Gary Stevens rode Ergun that day, but he had already previously committed to the Kentucky Derby on a horse called Brocco, on which Gary won the Santa Anita Derby. So now Ergun needs a rider for the Kentucky Derby, and Bailey was offered the mount, and he chose to go that direction. Well, I was sitting in the jocks room at Santa Anita a couple of weeks before the Derby, and the phone rang. Nobody was around, so I answered the phone. I said, hello, Santa Anita jocks room, how can I help you? Like I'm an official. And he says, yeah, this is Nick Zito. I'm looking for Chris McCarron. I said, what? Hi, Nick. Hi, this is Chris. He goes, what are you doing answering the phone? I said, it's a stroke of luck.
Good move.
So, yeah. So right away it hit me. I said, oh, do you need a rider for Gopher Gin? He says, yes, I do. All right. Yeah, I'd love to ride him. He said, well, I want you to fly back here to Louisville on the Saturday before the Derby, and I want you to breeze him, work him over the track at Churchill. And when I did that, I was so impressed with the way he worked out, the way he handled the surface at Churchill, that I called my wife and I said, you better make some plans to go to the Derby. This horse is going to be a good one. And so on the day, as you said, it was raining, track was sloppy, and it was dark and overcast. So as I straightened down the backstretch, that particular year at Churchill, they had a Jumbotron television screen situated on the far turn at about the 3 furlong pole, and it was at an angle, and that was to benefit the people in the infield so they could watch the race. Well, it was because of the darkness, it was very luminous. And so as I turned down the backstretch, I was in front and I'm watching that TV monitor. I'm watching it as I go down the backstretch and I'm looking for Holy Bull. And he was back in fifth or sixth place. And Holy Bull was a speed horse. He was expected to be in front, but he didn't get away from gate very well. So he was off and going slowly. I mean, off and got hampered. So he wasn't able to utilize his normal speed. So as I'm going down, I'm looking for him and I see he's way back there. My confidence just swelled. So I was able to springboard that confidence into patience. So I just waited and waited and waited. I waited till we turned into the stretch. And when I asked him to run, he took off. And he just sailed on home and he won the race by about a length and a half.
Yeah, it was an impressive win on in tough conditions on that day, but a memorable second Derby win for you. You've mentioned some of the trainers that you work with, Van Berg in particular, but I always am curious about the relationship with between trainers and jockeys, because we see in the winner's circle after every race there are two happy faces, and then the other guys are walking by and the expressions vary, and some of them are kind of grim sometimes. But tell me about working with the trainers and what those conversations are like, maybe just pre-race and then immediately post-race?
Well, fortunately, because of my success, I didn't very often get instructions from the trainers. They might suggest something. They might suggest a way that I should be riding the horse in the race. But at the end, I have to go out there and use my own judgment. I might try to follow a trainer's. I would try to follow a trainer's instructions, whether it be, you know, put this horse in the lead, try to go to the front, or I want you to be in a stalking position, or I want you to come out of the gate and just grab a hold of him, take him back, and make one run. And I would always try to complete that, but there were times when something happens in the early stage of the race and all of a sudden you have to go to plan B. Well, I would go ahead and rely on my own judgment at that point. And most of the trainers were very amenable to that. So, the great Charlie Whittingham, who trained Sunday Silence and Ferdinand, he won two derbies in the span of 3 years. He always said that I don't give jocks instructions because The bad jocks can't follow them, and the good jocks are going to do what they want anyway.
Yeah, that seems like a realistic approach. That certainly worked for him. You still meet with jockeys pretty frequently, and I've heard you say that today's jockeys seem to know more about the business of racing, and you've said that that's a good thing, but tell me how that's evolved over the years.
Oh, yeah, I keep in touch with my friends. We get together and play golf every once in a while, and I play a lot of golf, but I get those guys, I get some of the guys to come out and play with me at Greenbrier. And so, I'm not going to the Derby this year, but the day like tomorrow, I'll be over there, and I will go into the jockey's room probably two or three times during the day just to go in and say hi, get some photographs with them, get some autographs, and what have you. And it's a very enjoyable exercise that I go through.
Mm-hmm. And I guess at the time that you started, of course, you're focusing on riding, maybe not necessarily the business end of racing, except for perhaps what you're going to be making if you win. But that's something that jockeys are, I guess, are more concerned about other aspects of the business, maybe might be a good way to say it.
Yeah, well, you know, the financial end of it, it's very, very important. It's crucial for the riders of today, the riders of whenever, to be frugal with their money, save their money as best they can, because you never know when tragedy is going to strike. And it's, and really, when it comes down to it, it's not a question of when. I mean, it's not a question of if it's going to happen. It's a question of when. Unfortunately, I'm trying to remember where it is. I think it was at Thistledown up in Cleveland, where a few days ago a jockey was thrown from his mount and is in critical condition in the ICU in a hospital up in Cleveland. And he's only about 20 years old. Mm. So one of the nastiest, cold, hard facts about the occupation is that two jockeys every year are killed and two more are paralyzed. And that's just in the United States. It's a very, very dangerous occupation. So one has to be very prudent with spending money and making sure you put away a good nest egg so that you have some money in retirement. And also if you have some money in the event of a tragedy.
You made your decision to retire in 2002, or that's when you actually retired. Tell me about what went into that decision to make that the right time for you.
Yeah, I retired on June 23rd of 2002. I was 47 years old at the time, and I just started looking ahead and thought, you know, I've done about as much as I can possibly do during my career, and I just wanted to be able to say that I can retire on my own terms and walk away from the game unscathed to a degree. I did suffer some injuries. I broke 12 bones. Most of them were minor. A couple of times with the left femur, it was a lot more serious. But fortunately, I never had any neck injuries or back injuries. So I was able to stay sound, and I thought I'd take advantage of the opportunity and go ahead and retire. And when I did, when I retired in June of 2002, I was hired by Gary Ross, who wrote and directed the film Seabiscuit. Mm-hmm. So he employed me as a expert advisor. And I also hired all the jockeys who rode the horses in the film. And additionally, I was Toby McGuire's mentor. I spent a lot of time with Toby. I went to his house in Hollywood Hills a few times a week, and we worked out on an equisizer. We put him through a very serious exercise regimen so he could lose some weight. But he must be a pretty good athlete, because he took to it like a duck to water. And then, of course, I had the small role of riding War Admiral in the match race, which we shot at Keeneland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's it was a milestone type of film and very well received, as I recall, and to have that kind of role in it. I mean, obviously, as a professional, you want to take a great deal of pride in the realism of the movie. It must have been very satisfying to contribute to that.
It certainly was, but I got a funny story. So Gary Ross, again, the director and writer, he's been a racing fan his whole life, and he was adamant about the fact that we need to sell it to the thoroughbred racing community, and in order to do that, the races have to be realistic. So he didn't want anybody sitting hard against their horse and looking for the hero and let the hero win. He wanted the races to look very competitive. And so when we were at Keeneland shooting the match race, each scene in every race that we shot was done in quarter mile segments. So Gary Stevens was on Seabiscuit and I'm on War Admiral, and we're on the far turn at Keeneland. And when they said action, we started going, and we broke off the quarter pole and raced down through the stretch. Well, knowing that Gary Ross wanted us to be realistic, I got down and I started riding my horse, and unfortunately my horse put a neck in front instead. You know, like Gary Stevens looks over and says, "So long, Charlie." Charlie Kurtzinger is the role I played. And all of a sudden my horse takes off and I beat him to the wire. And so I'm supposed to get beat four lengths. So we go back, we dismount, let the horses catch their breath and get ready for the second take. But we went into the grandstand at a place called Video Village, where they have all these monitors set up, and everybody watches the race, the replay of the scene we just shot. And so the director looks at me and says, what's going on? You know the script. You're supposed to finish second. Yeah, I'll get it right the second time. So we go out, do it a second time with the same result. And now the director is fuming. He's like, come on, Chris. I only got so much time of light. My director, the DP, director of photography, said, we've only got like 30 minutes left of light. And we can't come back tomorrow. So he says to me, can you tell me exactly what the heck's going on? I looked at him with a grin on my face, and I said, what can I say, boss? I still got it. They just want to run for me. So
competitor forever.
So I selected a different bay horse for Gary Stevens to ride, and I kept the same black horse because I figured after two takes, he's probably getting a little tired, so he might not be as eager to. So on the third take, we were able to get it done.
One of the other parts of your life since retirement was the North American Riding Academy, where you had a chance to influence some young riders coming along. Tell me about that segment of your life.
Yeah, that idea was first spawned in 1988. I was in Tokyo to ride a horse from California at the time, the biggest race in the world, the most lucrative race in the world, $3 million Japan Cup. And I also was scheduled to ride the following weekend in Osaka in what they call a super jockey competition. I represented the United States along with Bill Shoemaker. And during the week, I got invited to attend and be a guest speaker at the Japan Racing Association School for Jockeys. And I was so impressed. It was a full academic program. They took all kinds of equine science courses as well as horsemanship and learning how to ride. And so fast forward 2 years later, June of 1990, I was scheduled to ride Sunday Silence in his first start as a four-year-old. I had previously won the Breeders' Cup Classic on him at Gulfstream Park, and he had several months off. Now he's coming back, and unfortunately, I was involved in another spill early in the day, and I broke my left femur again. I broke my right fibula and my right ulna in my arm. And so that put me out for some time. And while I had that time off, I was thinking, if this was the type of injury that would end my career, what would I want to do next? And I thought maybe train horses, you know, become a horse trainer. But then I said, you know what? I think I might think about starting a school for jockeys. We desperately needed one. Every other country in the world that has major horse racing has a school through which the jockeys must go before they can even apply for a license. It's not so. That's not how it is in this country. So I set out. I started reducing my thoughts to paper, and I figured that the best place to do it would be in Central Kentucky, because I know how I just had a feeling that it would be well supported, as opposed to in California. I just didn't feel like I would be getting the kind of governmental support, state support, that I probably could get here in Kentucky. So I moved when I retired in 2002. I worked on Seabiscuit, and I was general manager at Santa Anita Park for a little bit, for a year and about 14 months. And then my wife and I moved back here, and I got together with Dr. Michael McCall, who was president of KCTCS. And he loved the idea, and he okayed it. And he put the money behind it, and we opened our doors 2 years later. and it's called the North American Racing Academy, and it's located at both on the Newtown campus on Newtown Pike and the Thoroughbred Center out on Paris Pike. So, and I taught for about 8.5 years, and then I decided to retire and play as much golf as I can.
And yeah, I understand you are playing a lot of golf. Golf and grandchildren, those are good ways to spend retirement time. It sounds like you're enjoying it very much.
I sure am. You know, someone asked me the other day, so how often do you play golf? I said, oh, only about once a day.
Try to keep it down to once a day. Well, Chris, I have to ask you, as we come up on Kentucky Derby 2023, we're just a couple of days away here recording with you on Thursday, May 4th. What are your thoughts on the 2023 Derby?
Well, the way it looks to me, Forte is the favorite, and he should be. He's the, you know, he's earned over $2 million in his career. He's won 6 out of 7 starts. He's trained by the great Todd Pletcher and ridden by the outstanding young jockey, Irad Ortiz, who's a multiple-time Eclipse Award winner. He's the best horse going in. Forte is the best horse going in. But I'm going to try to beat him with Angel of Empire. He's 8-1 on the morning line. But getting back to the field itself, I think there's about 5 or 6 colts in there. If any one of those were to win it, it would not be a big surprise to me. I think it's a very competitive field, despite the fact that there's 20 in there. But I think at least a half dozen, maybe 7 or 8 horses that can really run, and they're coming up to the race in good fashion.
Well, we wish you the best, and hope you enjoy this Derby under a little different circumstances. But you and your friend have a great time, and enjoy the 2023 Derby along with the rest of us. It's been great to talk with you, and I appreciate during what is probably a busy time for you taking some time out to talk with us. Thanks for being on today, Chris.
And thank you, Keith. I really appreciate the opportunity you've given me, and I wish everybody out there happy Derby Day.
Happy Derby Day. Thank you, Chris.
Thanks, Keith.
You've been listening to the WUKY Sports Page with your host, Keith Elkins, an exclusive podcast from 91.3 WUKY, produced at the WUKY studios by Alan Lytle. Our theme music is Peanut Butter and Jam by Illogical Bit, available at soundcloud.com/illogicalbit. Subscribe to the Sports Page through iTunes, Google Play, or at our website, wuky.org.